There's no such thing as an unfettered right. All rights imply responsibilities.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Peter Lipman. Peter is the former founding chair of Transition Network and Common Cause Foundation. He also chaired the UK government's Community Energy Contact Group. Peter's been a teacher, a cooperative worker, and he helped set up Anthropocene Actions, a community interest group that promotes loving and ecologically regenerative societies. In this free-ranging conversation, Peter and I talk a lot about philanthropy, power, and privilege. Peter always challenges me in a good way and invites me into a deeper consideration of my ethics and choices. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Let's dive right in with Peter Lipman. We are here today with Peter Lipman. Peter is a director of Anthropocene Actions and a consultant in the philanthropic space. Thanks so much for doing this, Peter.
It's really a pleasure to be here.
And we're here at the Planet Local Summit in Bristol, where you call home. How is it to have us all in your backyard?
It's just amazingly convenient. You know, you spend your time either on Zoom or traveling to meet people, and then suddenly loads of people who you haven't seen for ages turn up in your home city. It's like Christmas come early.
And one thing I've noticed or observed is that you are very intentional about not necessarily traveling a lot overseas and taking a lot of flights. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I suppose the guiding principle underlying that is the more privilege we have, the more we should think really carefully about the use we make of that privilege and the impact it has on other people. And that's aligned with a very strong belief that there's no such thing as an unfettered right. All rights imply responsibilities. So as in global terms, a member of a global polluting elite living a normal-ish Western lifestyle, that's guided my choices and decisions as much as possible, really. So that's one of the reasons why I'm a vegan and have been for over 35 years. Exactly the same kind of thinking as to I really need to minimize seriously polluting activities like flying.
Mm-hmm. Can you share how these philosophies may inform your work in the philanthropic field?
I suppose the immediate manifestation of it is that, firstly, that the money that exists in philanthropy is inevitably going to result at some level from extraction, and therefore, if we are able to make it available to people who are, for example, resisting extractivism and trying to make positive changes in the world, that's not a kind of an act of generous munificence. That is a much needed reparation. And so the role of philanthropy is to be of service to those who are doing something about what's going on in the world. So it's not something to be proud of. And that means that I see a lot of philanthropy as actually doing the exact opposite of what I believe in. So the philanthropy of, let's say, a Bill Gates, which is being used to shape the structures of the world, particularly the structures in parts of the world which have less financial power and clout, such as the Gates-supported work around agri-tech in Africa, that shouldn't be called philanthropy from my perspective, because that's actually about the use of power to shape the world in a way that is amenable to our existing dominant systems and forces of power.
Mm-hmm.
So philanthropy in the way that the people I work with are trying to do it is about being of service, not pushing yourself forward and claiming that you're being generous, like in line with various religious traditions, where the highest form, the most sacred form of giving, is anonymous giving. So yeah, I think, and it also, I suppose, ties into my belief in the in human beings' natural ability to be empathetic and positive and loving and creative. And we got the ability to be the exact opposite of all of those things as well. But, you know, create the conditions for people to act on those intrinsic values as opposed to the kind of extrinsic values which get brought out when people are scared or defensive, etc.
And how do you practice taking yourself out of the act of exerting that influence, that power that comes with money or resources, even when it's done anonymously, even if it's to the best well-intentioned of supporting those and really being of service? There's still an inability to completely separate oneself and one's role.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious how you go about that.
Yeah, and it's not as if one can immediately disassociate from the overall context. And the overall context of philanthropy is people with power and privilege deciding to use it in a particular way and then giving money and other forms of support to other people. There's a massive power imbalance in that. And there are various attempts in philanthropy, in some small parts of philanthropy, to kind of address that and do something about that. In terms of the bits of philanthropy that I've been working with, I suppose there's a real attempt to make it an ongoing relationship rather than something where the power holder, the money giver, says, right, you have to jump through these hoops and make these kinds of reports and do exactly what fits with us. It's kind of trying to reverse that and say to people, we want to support you. We're really interested in what the learning is from that, but rather than us saying you have to report back in a particular way, we want you to tell us what works for you and how you learn from things. It's about not saying to people every 2 or 3 years you have to come up with a shiny new project that we will support and then drop you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about having an ongoing relationship if that works and there's alignment, while also trying to balance that with the fact that, you know, we have a particular vision and there needs to be that alignment. So it's messy, but it's a messy world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Can you share more about what some of those visions that you have are? Like, where do you find alignment in the work?
Well, for me personally, I was very affected back in my 20s when I read Animal Liberation by Peter Singer and was introduced to the concept of speciesism. And I can remember I was a kind of eat meat three times a day if I possibly could, kind of in my 20s, young man. And I came across this book, and somewhere in the introduction he kind of said, you know, if you try not to be a racist, if you try not to be a sexist, etc., why would you be a speciesist? Why would you use other species just for your own purposes? And I can still remember where I was sitting when I read it and the feeling of, oh shit, I haven't got an answer to that question. So yeah, I've been a vegan a very long time. And I suppose in terms of the kinds of principles in the philanthropy, it's about a respect for the beauty and sacredness of all forms of life, not thinking that human beings are more or less important than other forms of life. That's a really important part of my approach.
Mm-hmm. And my sense is that your work has been global in nature, and that you've kind of, you know, spent a lot of time in some of the pondering bigger questions of how do we navigate as a collective species in this moment in time. And I'm curious if you can just kind of paint us a picture a bit about where do you believe we are, and maybe some of the movements or some of the projects or initiatives that you're paying most attention to.
Yeah, well, I've always been fascinated by the kind of emergent power of collective action. And in fact, the reason I ended up doing some work with philanthropy as well as kind of setting up Anthropocene Actions was that I'd been doing work with a sustainable transport NGO here in the UK around how do people redesign the spaces between their houses, i.e. the roads or the streets, which have become predominantly spaces for cars, highways. How do they redesign them as social spaces? And what does that do to the culture? And kind of building on that, I became really interested in community action, not just around social space stroke highways, but around energy, around all of these kind of really important flows that we have. And that ended up with me co-founding Transition Network back in the noughties with Rob Hopkins and Ben Brangwyn. And that was about community level responses to climate breakdown and resource scarcity and unleashing that, not just that collective power, but kind of exercising the relational tissue of community cohesion and resilience and action. And that's kind of guided really a lot of my thinking. So, you know, I was at that point really, really concerned by how it felt as if a lot of the responses to climate breakdown. And I'm wary about the massive focus on climate, because although it's absolutely incredibly important and urgent, and we're seeing this massive acceleration at the moment, it's just one of a whole set of issues that for me come from both a dominant system of how we arrange our lives. You know, you can kind of call it capitalism, or you can call it, you know, a lot of things, but that dominant system doesn't help us to live in a way that is in balance with the rest of nature, and doesn't acknowledge our absolutely fundamental embeddedness within nature. And to kind of say, well, there's this untapped superpower of human potential to act in a very different way, to live in very different ways. What architectures or infrastructures or processes can unleash that? So through Transition Network, I got to meet various bits of philanthropy, which then I ended up, when I left the job with the Sustainable Transport NGO, ended up kind of doing some work with. And that belief in the enormous potential of bottom-up action is allied to a really strong belief that as things unravel, as, you know, it's not just climate, it's not just loss of biodiversity, it's not just extraordinary acceleration in inequality and all of the old dominant system structures of colonialism and other such things. It's a need to try to respond to all of those things together and not to assume continuity, not to assume the Holocene anymore, but to say, how do we respond? And the safety lies in community. We're social beings. So safety lies, therefore, in building structures where we respond together and where we enable people to feel safe and therefore brave. So we don't say to people, if you haven't got money, you're going to be homeless, you're going to starve. We don't say to people, if you happen to be born in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, you know, we will not let you come to places where there's work. We will drown you in the Mediterranean. So it's undoing those structures and processes that terrify people and make people desperate. That for me, that drives my work. So I am although a lot of my work is focused on biodiversity and social change. You know, I don't see these things as all being in separate silos.
Right.
I see them as all interconnecting. So the fact that borders are now more and more brutal and violent and dangerous. And basically, if you happen to be born in a very poor country, you're going to be excluded. And if you happen to be born in one of the old imperial centers of power, you're going to be able to go wherever you want. And you're not going to worry yet about food for your child. Although, you know, with climate breakdown and other stuff, that picture is changing remarkably fast at the moment. All of these things link together for me.
Right. When you described that moment that you had reading Speciesism,
yeah.
How do you say it?
Speciesism, but the book was called Speciesism. Animal Liberation, but yeah.
I had a similar moment when I first came across Transition Network. Okay. I was very much in like this alienated early 20s, just what the fuck is going on in this world and not understanding. And I remember when I read one of the pamphlets or books and I was like, oh my gosh, like people get it. Yeah. This just resonates. This just makes sense to me. I'm curious, you know, having seen that arc, because Transition Network is still having profound influence and ripples, you know, across the movement. You know, one critique I've seen is, oh, well, you know, they've been calling for peak oil now for however many decades and it hasn't come. Or, you know, we thought by now that some of these transitions from fossil fuels would have been forced upon us. Mm-hmm. And here we are extracting more and more out of the ground. I'm curious, yeah, like what are some of the reflections of lessons learned and maybe not just specific to Transition Network, but, you know, having been in these movements for so long, mm-hmm. what calibrated over time where you're like, oh, I really overestimated this or underestimated that?
Certainly on that kind of saying this is going to happen by a certain time. You know, people in Transition Network was never really about experts in a particular discipline. It was an attempt to weave together lots of different pieces of expertise and suggest processes where communities could grapple with them. And you know, I look at what's happened with the supply of oil, and actually there was a peak in the supply of conventional oil. Mm-hmm. You know, we're well past that. Certainly, people in transition, I think, took the word of the experts on that just as the word of the experts and didn't necessarily think of just how resilient capitalism would be about coming up with unconventional oil and massive amounts of it.
We will pump fresh water in the ground.
We will pump fresh water in the ground and loads of chemicals, and we will poison the water supply for generations and generations in order to produce a kind of Ponzi scheme fracked form of fossil fuel. You know, we will do almost anything. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to pause on the use of the word we. So I, you know, like you, I end up using the word we, but it's a really dangerous word because we has a universalizing about it, which means it can be, it can end up ascribing responsibility to all human beings. Mm. And that feels to me totally wrong. You know, a peasant farmer in Bangladesh who can no longer farm because they're flooded, and because she or he, and because of that, she or he therefore has to flee to a city. Mm. They're not part of that we. Their carbon emissions are absolutely minuscule. Mm-hmm. Your and my emissions, living so-called Western lives, and you know, the whole word Western is a weird one too, because who decides? Totally.
I was going to ask you, how do you frame it?
So I think
dominant culture, Western.
I think words like dominant culture are more useful. And just every time I say we, or I hear someone saying we, I just now have this kind of automatic who is being talked about,
right?
And that's not from, I hope that's not from a sense of judging or othering the people who are being talked about, because, you know, human beings are fundamentally social animals, and we, and I do mean all human beings when I say that, we are really shaped by the cultures, the norms, the environments that we find ourselves in. And so, you know, much as I regard, let's say, a Rex Tillotson or a Henry Kissinger or a Tony Blair as implementing things which are fundamentally crimes against humanity, I also see that from their perspective, they're not doing that. From their perspective, they're actually doing something which is of meaning and use. Doesn't mean I like what they do. Doesn't mean I would like them, but it does mean I try to check myself from judging them. I think I can 100% oppose what they're doing without necessarily thinking that I'm somehow better than them.
Right.
Although, of course, like most ego-driven human beings, I do fall into thinking I'm better than them, you know.
Yeah, because it's like in an effort to avoid the othering of, well, they are doing the fracking, you know, like I want to acknowledge my place in it and how implicated I am in it, and I certainly am. But I really appreciate this point of awareness of when saying we, who is really in that totalizing collective we.
Yeah.
So getting back to maybe, you know, any other reflections on kind of the arc of learnings?
Mm. Yeah, so there was a learning about the danger of making apparently confident predictions about when things are going to happen.
Right.
For me, there were half learnings or things that still are being grappled with around difficulty of finding the right line between making things accessible and not too scary in terms of the implications, and actually asking fundamental questions of status quo structures and setups. So, for example, if you're looking at a very common transition kind of community piece of work, they're trying to set up community-owned renewables. What does community-owned mean in that context? And usually in countries like the UK, community-owned means those with excess money have more control because they have shares. And yes, there's a community benefit fund, and maybe that grows over time. But the fundamental is a maintenance of a status quo where some have more than others in terms of financial power. And I suppose as I stepped back from transition, one of the questions I was asking myself was, could we have, we, Transition Network, have been more active in trying to seed experiments around saying that over time, a controlling interest has to pass away from the shareholders into some kind of community entity to really undermine that to those that have even more shall come sort of inevitability or feeling of inevitability. Mm-hmm. And that's still staying within the boundaries of only thinking about human stakeholders.
Right.
And so there was certainly there wasn't much exploration of what does it mean to acknowledge other than human stakeholders, because if a community is doing renewable energy, what does that mean for the other than human stakeholders, all of the biodiversity in that area, and how do you give that a voice? And so that, yeah, that just lots and lots of lessons. And I think one of the pressures on community-led responses is always just capacity, not just financial, but, you know, more importantly, human capacity to take step back, learn, try different experiments, not fall into othering, but maintain a meaningful critique. All of these things are hard and messy. And I suppose another learning was, you know, I'm really proud of what happened, is happening through the transition movement. And at the same time, it feels like just one tiny piece of a jigsaw in terms of a proportionate response to what's needed now.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like, to me, the resonance is really rooted in this bottoms up grassroots community, local kind of ethos, where in a climate context, all action is fundamentally local. But also, as you said, you know, we can't really separate a lot of the social and environmental issues and put them in their own little buckets. They're all interconnected. And so by having this holistic perspective, but looking in kind of a bioregional context or a local town context, then the healing happens across a lot of different dimensions. My experience now is somewhat become exasperated by how much capacity building is required. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the undoing of these, you know, aspects of capitalism that kind of hold us intact in a certain way. But you know, so much also we've like forgotten how to grow food. We've lost our ability to like get along with our neighbors. Like we've don't participate in civic meetings anymore. And we vote maybe once every 4 years and think that that's democracy. And like, and there's such a like multi-generational gap now between what seems to me like would be sustainable, regenerative, local living to where we are today. And so when you get these solutions offered by large economies of scale, you know, proliferating through the hyper accelerating capitalist system, it's enticing because it's like, great, we can, you know, plop one of these in every town and village, you know, there's a new widget that can like solve that so that not every local place has to learn all of that again and come up with all of that and so forth. And yeah, I'm curious, like your reflections and how you're kind of balancing these tensions or seeing these things.
Well, I suppose I get frustrated by the lack of a proportionate response. I try to remember that actually there are peoples all over the world totally living proportionate responses. You know, when you look at, for example, resistance to the development of extractive industries, whether it's, you know, fossil fuels or other forms of mining or whatever, you know, when you look at the way that indigenous-led campaigns or resistances function, you know, those show the crucial importance of a real connection to land base and a real connection to a culture of we take responsibility for what's around us. And as you say, that can feel very difficult in cultures where there is a longer history of separation. And of course, the UK, we're sitting here in Bristol, one of the cities that grew richer out of the slave trade, one of the cities that certainly grew rich out of the Industrial Revolution. So one of the kind of pioneer cities in alienation, really, and in separation from that kind of level of connection, which means that we're going to have a much more instinctive understanding, not just of connection to natural processes all around us, but connection to each other. Because in those sorts of cultures, you depend on each other. You don't depend on a kind of alienating abstraction like money and think that safety comes from money. So I think one of the things that really inspired me from transition was how it rang such a chord with peoples all over the world. I mean, I'm not talking about indigenous peoples, you know, but it took off in very different places and very different cultures. And so it showed that there is a longing or a desire to move away from this kind of classic Western capitalist alienated way of being. It also showed the difficulty of doing that. As you say, if you're trying to grow your own potatoes, and potatoes in terms of the cost and therefore the time it takes to earn that money incredibly cheap at a local supermarket, then you'll tend to fall back on what's incredibly cheap. So you've got this, the classic problem of doing what I'd call prefigurative work, i.e. work trying to be in the new world, even though the old world is still dominant. You've got the classic problem where you have to not only be motivated to do that, but in some sense, you have to be able to afford it, whether it's in terms of time or money or whatever else. And that is a thing of privilege. Totally. So it comes back to, you know, what does it mean to go against these dominant flows, norms? And that's why, actually, for me, that's why social change and in getting to some level of more environmental sustainability are totally interconnected. Unless we, by we, I mean people trying to enable environmental sustainability, unless we're thinking about reparation for inequality, for past exploitation, I think we're doomed to fail. So I'm really heartened by seeing the growth in environmental justice movement, seeing the growth at the moment in just this year, a massive uptick in not just movements talking about reparations, but now governments in the Caribbean saying to Western former colonial powers, you know, you can't just go on ducking this forever. It's tricky because obviously more and more people in those imperial centers, such as the UK, are now struggling as we see multiple interlocking crises, meaning that food prices go up, cost of living goes up, inequality spirals. So to most of those people, you know, if someone comes along and says, well, we need to make reparations for these things that were done by your ancestors, not by you, they're going to say, I'm not even surviving at the moment. So okay. Where does that come from? But of course, there is an extraordinary, enormous amount of money, if you want to measure it in money, available. Okay, it's squirreled away in offshore tax havens and other places, but there's enormous amount of money available if we got real about redistribution. And if we said, actually, being born human means you are entitled to food, shelter, education, safety, respect, and, you know, just the idea that any person should be homeless in a sane society, that is a sickness. And in many cultures, they look at that and they say, well, why, you know? So for me, all of these things lock in together.
Yeah.
The thing that kind of rattles around inside my head is just how fast our natural systems are creaking at the moment. And, mm-hmm. you know, the 2023 is like such an acceleration from 22, and 22 was scary enough. But these just literally off the charts, global temperatures, global average temperatures, surface sea temperatures, etc. You know, what we're seeing at roughly 1.2 degrees of warming shows that the people who kind of talk about, oh, well, you know, maybe we'll be able to keep it to 1.5 and maybe we won't. I'm just thinking, what universe do you live in? Because at 1.2, people are really mm-hmm. suffering and dying and struggling. And so everything, I feel like all the changes I'd love to see are completely feasible. How they happen as fast as, from my perspective, they need to happen, I don't know. But that means we have to take risks, we have to experiment, we have to not rely on some kind of long arc of justice idea, but say, what do we do to enable cultural and social change to happen rapidly right now? And clearly, as things fracture and break down, you've then got a potential for both positive change, where right. people say we want to do it differently. You've got a really scary potential for regressive change, where people get really scared and they turn to populist strongmen, and it's almost always men. And you look at both election and other than election consequences around the world, and clearly people will also turn to those who demonize others, scapegoat others as a way to take power, and have done so from time immemorial.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what, I mean, to me, I probably index higher on a fear that I hate the terms left and right. It's just like, and I don't like to reinforce it, but as we currently understand politics, I do worry about authoritarian tendencies coming from the left.
Right.
And I don't feel like I'm in a popular camp with that fear among my, you know, collaborators, so to speak. But I just worry that when we try to implement some of these social justice types of programs or climate response programs, and we have then a mimetic way of organizing around them, that we can also end up with just, you know, lots of other scary behaviors, whether it's around, you know, censorship or control, or, you know, different versions of lockdowns. And I have a bit of like just this like lingering fear that is one possible scenario of how this goes off the rails. We know that it's another, you know, likely scenario that the populist, you know, type of figure comes in from the shadows, and that this leads to just devastating wars. You know, like we know that this is also a very high risk. And it does seem like we need to be thinking about the risks of our response. Like I've witnessed over and over that you cannot get elected in most jurisdictions if you're saying, yes, we want people to come over our borders, right? And you mentioned like the violence at borders, like it ends up being so highly politicized. And so you have this really perverse incentive structure where, you know, you don't want to bring these qualities of empathy and collective human well-being, because you need to make sure that you're maintaining power in your jurisdiction. But we have this huge, please push back, but we have this huge climate refugee challenge that's going to be right around the corner. So anyway, I've said a lot there, but yeah, curious what you think. And I'm just trying to like provoke and prompt you a bit.
So yeah, a few things. Just trying to work out what order. I mean, the first thing is we're seeing that absolutely is a danger and a threat from that kind of left authoritarian response. We're already seeing that far more from the right authoritarian response, you know, around the world.
Yep.
And I don't need to list the jurisdictions for that. So we need to think about both of those, obviously. In terms of the left authoritarian response, I mean, this is a schism that has existed in left politics, you know, back from the splitting of the International, back from the division between Marx and Bakunin over, you know, between an anarchist approach and a communist approach, or however you want to put it. And there are various readings of Marx on it anyway, but, you know, there has always been a left approach which is fiercely passionate about the need for liberty as balanced by responsibilities, going back to what I said right at the beginning. So, you know, I would align myself with that kind of, you know, left approach, which is opposed to a kind of Stalinist discipline, a kind of, you know, this is what the party says and therefore that is the truth, you know. And in fact, I was, you know, in my teens, I was a member of a pretty Stalinist left movement here in the UK called Militant Tendency, and I was expelled for asking too many questions, you know. So yeah, maybe nothing's really changed. I also just wanted to pick up on what you said about us having been shown that a government can't be elected if it's welcoming migrants. And I want to push back on that very strongly. I mean, just this week, there's been a piece of research published by Piketty and a partner looking at long-term voting patterns in French communes, you know, as in the kind of local democratic structure in France, kind of pushing back on that. And, you know, when I look at the UK, which is where I kind of understand the ebb and flow of politics best, when in 2017, Jeremy Corbyn had very unexpectedly become the leader of the Labour Party and was definitely proposing a very different approach to immigration, to asylum seekers, to refugees, proposing the kind of approach that I would propose. You know, he came in, he got the highest percentage Labour Party vote since the war, and he came incredibly close to winning that election. Right. And in fact, what became known after the election was how the internal Labour Party bureaucracy had deliberately sabotaged the Corbyn-led effort in that campaign, to the extent of when his team moved into Labour Party headquarters, all the computers had been taken out, to the extent that the Labour Party bureaucrats were running anti-Corbyn campaigns on Facebook secretly, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're told that you can't win if you take a, let's say, pro-social, pro-human approach. And then when you also look at the public opinion surveys in the UK, in the US, in other places, people are way more left or liberal or welcoming than politicians think. So I see a massively dangerous shaping of that kind of view by a very right-wing mainstream media combined with some pretty far-right politicians.
Yep.
Creating that story. I think it's a story. I think, as I said right earlier on, you know, human beings have immense capacity for both love and compassion and empathy and sharing, and for being scared and defensive and then aggressive and excluding.
Totally.
And we swim through a cultural sea which tells us we need to be scared and defensive rather than loving and welcoming, all of us.
Yeah.
In dominant culture societies like the UK, like New Zealand, like US.
I appreciate that. And yeah, maybe my statement was too encompassing. I want to like follow up and research it more, because my experience is very much shaped by the United States and New Zealand, where, you know, just over and over see this defensiveness against immigrants, against migrants. And And I see the incentive structure where it's like, well, housing's more and more expensive. Mm. Food's more and more expensive. Livelihoods are just more and more challenging to maintain. And the numbers of folks that are going to be trying to come into areas that are habitable and functioning is just going to continue to probably rise on a fairly exponential curve. No?
Well, it feels as if there are, if you believe that and you want to do something about it, then you don't necessarily go around saying to people, we should welcome migrants. You, for example, you put all your time and energy into campaigning for universal basic assets so that fear is taken away. If people know that they can access shelter and food and education, they're going to be far less worried about the impact of a flow of migrants into a place. So, yeah, I mean,
totally.
What can we do to take away the fear, I suppose, is my fundamental response to that.
Also, it's all of the above, right?
Yeah, yeah. Not just the fear, the guilt. Mm. You know, I do wonder when I look at, and this is, you know, completely as an outsider, not someone who really understands US culture, but when I look at US culture, I see a lot of guilt-driven behavior, you know, cultures that are based on imperial pasts or on past genocides, that there's an immense amount of work to do around that.
Totally.
At a cultural level to enable people to not feel scared and guilty, I suppose. Yeah. Now, that's an easy thing to say at a meta level, isn't it? And so the question is, what does that look like at a local level? And for me, at a local level, that partly looks a bit like a transition type process where you're kind of exploring all of the things we depend on to feel safe, you know, food and energy and housing and other such. But it also looks like a really important questioning of representative democracy. So as you said earlier, you know, going to vote every 4 years, does that make us feel powerful or responsible? I don't think it does. So what does participatory democracy look like in practice? And with that, I think we've seen over the last few years in lots of places a really interesting explosion of interest in assembly type processes. Yeah. I'm personally much more interested in people's assemblies than I am in citizens' assemblies. In other words, in
What's the difference?
So people's assemblies, I mean, speaking very broadly, people's assemblies come from people's desires to explore certain questions and are led by that rather than citizens' assemblies, which often come from a kind of top-down, the government says, we really need to get people more involved in this and we'll be interested in what they say, but we won't necessarily do any of it. But, you know, citizens' assemblies can be run better. But for example, you know, the process of change in Chile over the last few years, where a whole range of people's assemblies were what brought a country together and eventually a referendum and, you know, the decision to design a new constitution and a whole load of political changes and the new constitution not getting through in the first instance and going back to the drawing board, which all feels like the kind of necessary messiness of people-led processes. But the extraordinary changes in Chile where you had, you know, a brutal right-wing dictatorship, you'd had the implementation of the most extreme form of neoliberalism and people risking their lives to change that and the People's Assembly process giving a kind of form and a process which enabled that energy to be challenged. You know, I mean, if they can do that in Chile, you know, that can happen in other places. So similarly, it's people-led processes that can enable this change. Like the massive changes in Colombia where you hadn't had a progressive government and you had decades of organizing leading to a fascinating new progressive government with a leadership that is doing its best to say, we want to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. And that's not a rich country saying that. You know, that's a relatively poor country, massively biodiverse country with a history of brutality and violence and death squads and everything like that. You know, if countries like that can do that, I think then, you know, those of us like you and me living in relatively privileged imperial or sub-imperial centers can maybe take a leaf from their book. And that also ties to my belief that actually the locus of change, mm-hmm. the necessary locus of change, is not in those imperial centers or former imperial centers. The locus of change is actually in the global south, where, again, at a massive generalization, generally the people do the real work that drives our privileged lifestyles, whether it's the mining or the growing of things that are then exported for us to consume, like coffee or whatever. You know, there's still a massive, effectively, subsidy from the global south, from the poor of the world, to the global north, to the rich of the world, which means they have a power. They can withdraw that, subject to imperial aggressive force in response, but, you know, they can withdraw that. And that's where I see the potential for change, really, the kind of change we need coming from the global south. And I would say that means that for those of us with global north privilege, it becomes a question of how do we use that privilege to support that.
How you mentioned, like, that so much of this is just cultural narratives, and I'm curious how you personally have become so well attuned to the power dynamics, to people who aren't being represented, to, you know, the folks that shouldn't be included in a totalizing we. Like, I mean, you're very, I think a lot of what you're speaking are statements that would be resonant with most folks, but you feel it and you're aware of it at a deeper level than what I normally encounter, especially for those of us in these privileged imperial centers. And so, I'm curious if you can share a bit more about either your practices or your journey, or maybe what has shaped that.
The shaping feels fairly clear to me. On my mother's side, they were a very affluent Jewish family in pre-World War II Germany. And her parents and she and her brother got out when she was two, just in time, really. And ended up in South Africa. So there was a history of you know, fleeing and danger. And then on my father's side, similarly, at a generation before that, they'd been fleeing danger in Europe and ending up in South Africa. And then they were both very involved in the liberation struggle in apartheid South Africa. My mother and father both drafted the Freedom Charter of the ANC, the declaration, helped draft that declaration of what are we working towards. In fact, my mother was the original scribe of the Freedom Charter.
Wow.
And they were risking their lives. And in fact, they got out of South Africa because my dad got a call from a childhood friend saying, "Alan, you need to get out. Your file is on my desk." Mm. And this childhood friend worked for BOSS, the Bureau of State Security. And their friends were being killed, you know, or going to jail. And all of those things meant that I grew up in a household in suburban Cardiff here in the UK, with people who had risked their lives for their principles, but people who had experienced not being in the center of safety and power. So it was like breathing, really. I mean, that's what you talked about. Mm-hmm. That's what you thought about. So I think that also means that because of that family background and the ripples of that, I don't have that sense of security that many have who've grown up, let's say, in a UK or a US. And clearly there are lots of people who, more and more maybe, who are growing up or living without that sense of security now, but, you know, in the underlying dominant culture, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's just been part of my shaping, and then a very conscious part of my political journey, really, which is, you know, goes back to that founding: if you have privilege, how are you going to use it, I suppose. And that's something which, you know, you can always be left with a feeling, I can always be left with a feeling that I could be doing more, I could be doing differently, I could be braver. So it's not a kind of ever a comfortable, right, I'm doing enough. It's a kind of constant, ongoing, this is what I'm doing. I don't want to beat myself up. Mm-hmm. And I do want to acknowledge all of the contradictions and paradoxes of trying to change things while being relatively privileged and comfortable myself, but not getting too comfortable in thinking, yes, I've got it right, ever. It's like, you know, a practice of every few years, at least kind of looking at what I'm doing and saying, is this really proportionate to what I could be doing given what's going on in the world?
Mm-hmm.
It's just how I try to do it. And I fail miserably lots of the time, like most of us.
Yeah, well, I mean, I appreciate how being in your presence, I've never felt like I'm being scolded for whatever stupid decisions I'm making or thoughts I'm having. But there is this kind of persistent coaxing into a more radical and more like facing truths sense. You know, when I reached out to you at some point a year or two ago and was like, are you going to this event? You know, and you're like, you know, no. So you said something to the effect of like, I'm not flying, right? And that stuck with me, you know, and it still sticks with me because every time I buy a plane ticket, I'm thinking about like, you know, and there's something about this question of how do we go through these processes culturally and socially and to enact that rapid change. And, you know, for those of us who don't come from families where it was just like breathing to think about some of these issues, like how do we create the environment where we're transforming rapidly? Yeah. And yeah, curious, any other reflections on those processes?
We're so socially determined. So I don't want it to feel as if this is saying that every individual has to somehow revolutionary change who they are, what they do. I suppose it's about, like I said earlier, exercising relational muscle in our communities where we welcome these kinds of explorations of what can we do together, and we move from the what can we do together into the then what's my role in that. That's why it feels to me that community processes which enable that, and there are lots of different versions of this, but which enable that in a way that really acknowledges the urgent reality, but also doesn't make people feel judged, are fundamental. But that's a really fine line, because actually, we're all of us making decisions that at times we shouldn't be making. So how do we get a kind of a fierce love for each other? That means that I can say to you, Matthew, I think you're an amazing human being, and why are you flying so much? While also acknowledging that there are times when I fly. Mm. You know, I don't completely cut it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's about kind of having a psychologically or spiritually, or however you want to frame it from, you know, your particular worldview, culture that assumes that we have to work at it, that's part of the responsibility of being human, is to work at the culture we're in. And that's partly why I set up Anthropocene Actions. And that's a double-edged name for me, by the way, Anthropocene, because there are very cogent arguments that the framing of the Anthropocene is a totalizing we, anthros, the all of humanity. And there are people who say it should be called the Capitalocene or the Plantationocene or whatever, you know, you name it. And I respect those arguments a lot, but I actually quite like the double-edged nature of it, because it means that I'm always thinking, who's the we? But, you know, in Anthropocene Actions, we're saying what kind of cultural interventions, architectures could make a difference. And so, for example, there's a project called Solidarity Matters, which came from my watching what was going on with the water defenders in North Dakota, and watching that amazingly beautiful upswelling of popular support from outside their core constituency to say, no, we're going to stand with you. And thinking about things like the process, which is rather beautifully captured in a film called Pride, where back in the miners' dispute in the 80s, a group in London of lesbian and gay activists decided they would support the miners in a particular community and reached out to them, raised money for them, went through all the how do you build a real relationship between radical queer activists in London and a rather traditional Welsh Valleys mining community. And partly as a result of that, the National Union of Mine Workers changed its position on gay marriage and equality and exercised its block vote in the Labour Party conference to support that, which led to the Labour Party then supporting gay marriage equality and radical change. So as an emergent consequence of this non-transactional solidarity that was offered, there was an extraordinary and beautiful result.
Mm.
And that film makes me cry every time I watch it, actually.
Mm.
But I was thinking, why don't we have more architectures to enable these linkages across silos, across differences, and so that people can start to work on building this extraordinary untapped superpower of human solidarity, not just with other humans, obviously, from my more biocentric perspective. And so we set up this program called Solidarity Matters to kind of explore with what would infrastructures, processes look like to enable that. And it's an ongoing experiment. But I those are the kind of things that really get me out of bed in the morning.
Hmm.
Other than I just love getting out of bed in the morning. There's so much to do and so much interesting and stuff and so many wonderful people to work with, you know. But it feels as if as the cracks really show more and more, and more people ask questions about this stuff, it's changed really over the last few years really quickly from a position where if you wanted to talk about polycrisis or climate breakdown, you had to spend a lot of time building the foundations of the language and the common shared understanding, to a position now where people are getting it. People are getting it for a whole range of different reasons, but they're getting it and they're saying, well, the current system just isn't responding. What might it look like? So it feels like we've got an extraordinary opportunity not to kind of solve things so that everything goes back to some kind of idyllic Eden type thing, because I don't feel, you know, the depth of damage is so deep and so rapid. I don't think we're going to, quote, solve it. But we can try to make a difference, try to mitigate it. And in trying, actually, we get, certainly for me, we get such purpose and meaning that actually I get a lot happier when I'm doing this kind of stuff.
Totally. Yeah, that's a common theme of folks I've talked to as well. I do want to invite some closing thoughts around where philanthropy can sit and what you've learned about that field and space, because we are exploring a lot of different topics around money and philanthropy. And I tend to feel like we are crossing a threshold in 2023 with these temperature charts, which are just insane, and the Arctic ice sheets.
Yeah.
And because it's one thing to put, you know, the planetary boundaries diagram on a slide and say, look, there's tipping points and there's limits. And once we get past it, this is what happens. It's another thing to see one in 500 year storms, one in 1,000 year storms scattered all over the place and charts that are just, you know, undeniable in terms of what's happening to our biosphere. And so I'm so curious, like, what, now that we're getting more extreme feedback from the natural world around us of the consequences of our actions, like what is this going to do and what is this going to change? And bringing it into the philanthropic context, I still feel so frustrated by how little money is going to climate-related causes and projects. And I also feel frustrated that I don't want to suggest that, you know, we need to take it away from education or social housing or anything else. And so that leads me to, well, okay, 95% of our capital is over here in endowments. Let's really have that conversation about how do we accelerate our efforts and move more quickly.
I would say that actually one of the things that scares me most is not the Arctic ice, it's the Antarctic ice at the moment. Really, wow.
Because we didn't think that was coming at this
pace. We
didn't
think that was coming anything like so fast. And there was just something the other day about, yet again, about just how quickly sea level rise can happen with what's mm-hmm. going on at the moment, potentially. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that you know, that can flip us into such a different world so quickly. And then you look at where is there money that potentially could pivot very really fast to do something about that. And obviously there's a massive amount of money in governments, but they've got so many other things going on. In theory, although philanthropy is nowhere near that scale or the scale of the mega corporations, you know, there's a lot of money there that could pivot really fast. But
yeah, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, totally. But then I think it's important to apply a kind of classic Marxist analysis, which is, you know, what's the function of philanthropy, you know, and actually in the main, the function of philanthropy to me seems to be to put sufficient of a sticking plaster over the gaping wounds, or to act as a sufficient of a pressure relief valve to enable the fundamental system that creates philanthropy, i.e. extractive capitalism, to continue. So expecting most of philanthropy to respond proportionately to me is just, I'm just not going to spend any time on that, because that's not what it's designed to do. Having said that, there is a kind of radical edge within philanthropy of people who see this and have decided or are open to the argument that we're not going to sort it out by propping up capitalism, and therefore let's move rapidly to support the kinds of initiatives you're talking about. And that's where I think the questioning of endowments becomes absolutely fundamental. The kind of, if you hold those kinds of perspectives or are exploring them, then what do you do with endowments becomes fundamental. And I've just come from a workshop that was partly about that. And one of the philanthropies that was at that workshop is a UK philanthropy called Lankelly Chase, who you may have come across. And what they're doing is an interesting experiment. I mean, I don't know that it's going to play out quite the way they see it, but they have an endowment of over 100 million sterling. And they've decided not to kind of do a classic spend down where they decide where that money goes, but they've decided that the process of spending down the endowment needs to undermine the traditional philanthropic holding on of power, of decision making, of who is worthy of support and who isn't, and to open that out to grantees and potential grantees, and to try to design a process where the people doing the work decide where that money gets used over quite a tight time period. I don't know if they'll manage to stick to their 5-year period or not, but that feels to me like a really brave experiment. And there are kind of other analogous experiments, like Chorus in the UK, who decided that they were going to divest themselves fully of the endowment. My understanding is they said, right, you can't just give this to communities. They don't have the infrastructure you need to handle that kind of money coming in. But through whatever process they use, they came up with 4 different communities, and they said, we're going to work with you over a 10-year period to build your community muscle and capacity to handle this money, to do community-based responses to everything that's going on in the world. And they're into the final year of that 10-year process. So there are brave philanthropies actually grappling with these questions. And I think it's really important that gets looked at and explored and experimented with more. There are processes like flow funding where people are saying, yes, there's a grant, and actually you recipients decide what you do with it. And there are processes, yeah, all of those sorts of processes. And basically it's like, it's a mini version of what I was talking about participatory democracy. Rather than saying, you know, the existing seats of power, governments, executives, get to decide what happens, it's reclaiming that agency in participatory democracy for all people. And in philanthropy, it's saying a kind of an analogous thing. Where does the power sit, and how do we question power? So fundamentally, all of this stuff is how we question power. And then for me, the added bit, which I feel like a complete neophyte, you know, struggling with, is how do we question the anthropocentric analysis of power, and how do we say that other than human voices have to be somehow brought into these decision-making processes and allocations. And of course, I studied maths and philosophy at university a long time ago. That didn't equip me to really grapple, well, maybe the philosophy bit did a bit, to try to grapple with how do you enable the voice of those who don't have voices, so whether they're human or not human. So, yeah, it's an exciting time because the speed of the fracturing and the loss actually means that some people are really open now to these questions in a way that they wouldn't have been a few years ago. And the other thing that I keep thinking or trying to base my actions on is that we've got nothing to lose. The current dominant status quo way of being is frankly suicidal. Mm-hmm. Not just suicidal, taking down a whole bunch of other stuff at the same time. So taking self-questioning, brave experiments and trying to act on them is what's left. And if they don't work, they're not going to solve it. They're not going to be a perfect solution, but there's learning in it. And just the process means that we change and develop. So yeah, I just feel like, I mean, I'm excited to go to work every morning because it's just such a time that is so full of potential. And that quote that's attributed to Gramsci about in between the dying of the old world and the birth of the new, that's the time of the monsters. Mm. And I think actually it was Romain who said it originally. But anyway, you know, it feels like that's where we are. And we've got this capacity as social beings to kind of be incredibly brave and creative in response to that. So, on the one hand, I feel this kind of surge of energy. On the other hand, I feel this massive grief for the gratuitous loss and suffering and pain that is being caused to both humans and other than humans, you know. And it's just like we were born onto this kind of Edenic planet, and let's do something about it while we still can, really. Well, I've loved talking to you. And it's really nice to be physically in the same space, yes, as opposed to being on Zoom. I suppose my final nugget is really that, you know, as I kind of play back what I just said in my head, I do wonder how much of that comes from my unearned privilege, that ability. But I have also repeatedly seen how much joy people get, no matter what the circumstances, from collaborative action. And, you know, as Rebecca Solnit wrote in her Paradise Built in Hell, you know, how people respond to urgent need can be the most beautiful thing. And so, you know, I kind of hold that close and dear to me.
Peter Lippmann, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, what'd you think of that one? Please leave us a comment below. To learn more about Anthropocene Actions, go to anaction.org. You can find more conversations like this one at maearth.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.